Welcome to A Writer in Italy, the podcast. I am your host, Michelle Johnston, and this is a little share in the world of travel, books, art, and lifestyle. I live in Australia, yet have long had an attraction to the Mediterranean countries for as long as I can remember. This inspiration has fueled my creative life and given me incredible joy over the years as an artist and a writer. And that is why I have created these shares on journeys that have been made, books that I have loved, and cooking adventures inspired by wonderful food writers. You can find all show notes at michellejohnston.life and follow me on Instagram at A Writer in Italy, where you can find all of the meanderings and indeed the lure of Italy as the ultimate muse. Thank you for joining me. I love having you here for the journey of Muse Italia. Welcome to the podcast. This is part two, Peggy Guggenheim, Art and Love. Arriving in the City of Miracles was fortuitous for Peggy Guggenheim. The meeting with Giuseppe Santomasso at the San Marco restaurant, the Angelo, turned serendipitous when Peggy was later invited by Rodolfo Pallucini, the Secretary General of the Biennale, to show her art collection. A happy coincidence for Peggy, since this also took care of one of her biggest worries, the tremendous cost of shipping all of her art from New York to Venice, Italy. 3 days before the Biennale opened, Peggy was invited to hang her pictures on beautiful white walls and freshly designed by Venetian architect Carlo Scarpa. Peggy's collection was one of the greatest attractions of the 24th Venice Biennale. In Out of This Century, Peggy said, quote, "My exhibition had enormous publicity and the pavilion was one of the most popular of the Biennale," end of quote. Fortunate it was on show too, that particular year, the American pavilion did not open, since the art did not arrive in time. Peggy's collection was not only a great modernist show of surrealism, abstract expressionism, futurism, and cubism, introducing many to the developments in art in New York and Europe and beyond, but also would at least represent Peggy's home soil, America. And for Peggy, that kind of acknowledgement was exciting and empowering. After the Biennale, the art would go on to tour Florence and Turin, while Peggy worked out a plan on how to keep the art in Italy, since it was only a temporary permit and taxes were exceptionally high. Moving to Venice to start a fresh chapter was the turning point in solidifying her position and making a definitive mark, although finding a place to buy and live in post-war Venice was not as simple as it sounded. In the meantime, Peggy enjoyed living in the Palazzo Barbaro, the Venetian palace where Henry James famously wrote the Aspern Papers and set a scene for his novella, The Wings of the Dove. Peggy holidayed on Capri in the Bay of Naples, one of her favourite places, the beautiful island she spent time on with her first husband, Lawrence Vale. Fortunate for Peggy, her brilliant accountant, Bernard Rice, managed to unlock the special code to one of her trusts. Getting around some inheritance law proved lucrative for Peggy and helped her afford a little palazzo on the Grand Canal in her personal miracle city. In 1949, the dream would become real. Flavia Poulon, the secretary of her friend Count Zorzi, would help Peggy secure an 18th century palace in the Dorsoduro district of Venice that was built for the noble Venetian family, the Veneers. The Veneers were most notable for their donation of two doges to Venice. Legend has it they kept lions in the garden. There were also 8 stone lion heads at the front of the palace and offers a perfectly acceptable reason why the palace would be called the Palazzo Venier dei Leoni. when the Vanir family commissioned the home to be built into a neoclassical palazzo on the bank of the Dorso Douro, they planned to make it one of the tallest buildings in the Sestiere, 5 stories and the widest of buildings in Venice. The scale caused much drama and dispute. The work anticipated taking years, but by the end of the 18th century, the family dynasty began to decline. When Niccolo Vanir died, work eventually halted. All that remained completed was the one single story of the white stone palace. Over time, the palace would be known by the locals who lived a stone throw away from the Accademia Bridge and Galleries as Il Palazzo Non Finito, the unfinished palace. Boasting a wonderful waterfront terrace, the simplicity of design was a welcome advantage. Since it had no formal ties to Venetian heritage, things could be structured and made to suit a gallery and a home. Not only did the palazzo, covered in vines, suit the conditions of a contemporary art space and private dwelling, but it had a wonderful large garden behind with established trees and greenery, indeed quite unusual for the city built on a marshy, salty lagoon. The garden would be ideal for Peggy's sculptures, and in a strange but beautiful way, the palazzo too mirrored the new beginning, since over the previous century, it too had played a pivotal role in the lives of 2 rather fascinating women, and already had a vibrant and poetic past. It does seem extraordinary that 2 women had lived rather eccentric lives at the white single-story abode on the Grand Canal. One being the vibrant Marchesa Luisa Casati, to escape her Milanese family and dynasty, yet mostly her husband and child. She was famously known around the lagoon for having African manservants and a few tigers in the garden. A wild woman who rented the unfinished palazzo, giving parties that writers still talk about. And the other, an English Viscountess, Doris Castle Ross. On a quest to flee London and keep a summer residence and enjoy the decadence and excess not frowned upon in a city like Venice. All 3 women in turn would create their own personal utopian fantasy. Quote, the promise of freedom and fresh beginnings. Venice lured each woman to imagine a new life, end a fresh chapter where the rules could not only be broken, but rewritten. In the beginning, the Palazzo Vanir de Leoni was opened on a few afternoons to the public, with a revolving door to friends and the art crowd of the time. The modern 18th century palace was the place to be. One of Peggy's first exhibitions was of her beloved sculptures, where the joy of sharing her pieces by Jean Arp, Alberto Giacometti, Alexander Calder took place. The decision to place the sculpture by Italian artist Marino Marini, the Angel of the Citadel, was an interesting one. In classic Peggy style, she had the horse and rider with erect phallus facing the Grand Canal and directly pointing across to the other side to the Prefettura. A symbolic gesture and captivating Peggy's lightness and irreverence. She was a little cheeky to do that. She loved to look at the pure form, the elegant silhouette from her office in profile. When visitors wandered up the steps from the waterfront terrace, it was entertaining to watch their reactions. Marini was no fool. He knew the sexual aura of the sculpture would challenge people, so he cast the phallus in bronze so it could be removed on demand. Peggy wrote, quote, when the nuns came to be blessed by the patriarch who on special holy days went by any house in a motorboat, I detached the phallus and hid it in the drawer. End of quote. Marini claimed the potent penis was symbolic of life force, energy, ecstasy, and joy. Peggy, over time, became an iconic figure floating about the canal in her own personal gondola, often with her beautiful Lhasa Terriers by her side. They called her La Peggy, quite the heroine of her own fate, She must have seemed an apparition when seen floating along the waterways, alongside the vaporetti, floating vessels and shipping barges. Not many local Venetians owned their own private gondola, only significant wealthy aristocratic families, in truth. And many preferred the newer motorboats as a form of transportation, although Peggy's gondola rides became a true sense of joy and calm as she aged, sitting in her beautiful carved vessel with lions on the cavelli. A 2-hour sunset ride with her gondolier at the helm was a dose of happiness and magic. Alone or taking a friend to visit a Tintoretto in a church, Peggy said, quote, "Venice is not only a city of freedom and fantasy, but it is also the city of pleasure and joy," end of quote. With her trademark butterfly glasses, designed by Edward Melcarth, and slight frame, she would cut an elegant figure on the Teal Lagoon. Never a handsome beauty, Peggy knew her flaws. Peggy once remarked that in Venice, quote, "one could almost wear anything and not look ridiculous," end of quote. Yet, not everyone appreciated Peggy's style nor the famous art collection. In fact, the locals were inquisitive and at times bewildered by the modern spectacle. In Peggy's autobiography, Out of This Century, she recounts Princess Luciana Pignatelli saying, quote, "If you could only throw away all those awful pictures into the Grand Canal, you would have the most beautiful house in Venice," end of quote. One worker helping clean up the exhibit for the Biennale mistook the Calda Mobile for packaging rubbish. Obviously, the art appeared to be useless, so he went to throw it in the bin. The art collector Douglas Cooper once wrote such a cruel takedown of Peggy's collection, denouncing it as an American Harris's, quote, "modish 20th century collection of art." No doubt, in the vain hope he could get his hands on one of Peggy's stunning Pablo Picassos or Georges Braque. He was an avid collector of Cubist art, after all. The late John Richardson pronounced in his memoir, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, quote, "Hard knocks had left Peggy with skin as thick as elephants," end of quote. She obviously forgave Douglas Cooper, since Peggy later gave him one of her Lhasa Apso dog's offspring. Peggy decided it would be a great cure for Cooper's temperament and, quote, "vile disposition," end of quote. Indeed it was. Cooper took the dog back to the Castile in Provence and went on to find a breeder to mate pretty little Bella with. Taking the good with the bad was a talent Peggy had mastered. She moved on. She knew she had the goods to back it up. Money, the palazzo in one of the world's most hedonistic and grandest of tourist destinations, a brilliant and lucky fate in itself, and the boatload of art she owned and simply adored. But Peggy would learn again and again that life was beautiful and life could be cruel. When her daughter Peggine died of an overdose in Paris in 1967, she was bitterly disappointed and mostly blamed Peggine's husband for the lack of help and foresight. A terrible circumstance surrounds this heartbreaking story, although Peggine was sadly an unhinged woman, a fragile beauty who suffered with heavy episodes of depression, drinking alcohol for comfort, and existing on prescriptive medications. The sadness of losing her beloved daughter Peggine would knock her to her knees. Peggy was nearly 70 years old and indignant at the pain she felt and the anger at Peggine's husband, Ralph Rumney. Peggy did not even attend the funeral. The daisy chain was broken, not to be rethreaded again. When Francine Prose opened her biography on Peggy Guggenheim, The Shock of the Modern, she shared a quote by the artist Lee Krasner. Quote, "In writing about Peggy, it's important to listen to one's own instincts. Don't listen to critics. What do they know? What one should say about Peggy is, simply, that she did it. That no matter what her motivations were, she did it," end of quote. Indeed, the New York artist Lee Krasner was right. There is a lot one can say about Peggy Guggenheim, and there are plenty of biographies to take your pick from. Even Peggy's own autobiography, Out of This Century, was altered numerous times in reprints and new editions. Peggy's life was full of myth and legend. People have been critical of her for her privilege and her personal choices. No matter her failings and her beautiful and particular idiosyncrasies, Peggy did do it, and that is that. At the very end of Peggy's life, the last years were spent planning and orchestrating what to do with her beloved art collection and gallery. Many options were on the table. The decision was deeply personal to Peggy and of utmost importance to get right. She couldn't rest until the detail was final. The decision to keep it in Venice was aided by the help of her son and daughter's father, Lawrence Vail, who felt it would be wise to keep it in Italy. Francine Prose, author of The Shock of the Modern, considered Vail undervalued in history as an advisor in Peggy's decision. A letter from Harry Guggenheim shares the same sense of the right place for the collection, Italy. The work did not go to the Tate London as toted, nor did it land back in New York. When the Louvre honoured Peggy at the Orangerie in Paris in 1975, she was full of pride and a sense of I told you so, since they had denied her protection at the advent of the invasion of the German army into Paris, concluding her collection not valuable in their eyes. Peggy held her resentments close. She was no stranger to a little revenge joy. An exhibition of her work in New York at the Solomon Guggenheim Foundation in 1976 would later cement her decision to keep the work in Venice under the guardianship of the Solomon R. Guggenheim Foundation. It seems an extraordinary thing that the director of the museum and Peggy Guggenheim collection this day in 2023 is Carol P. B. Vail, the American Museum director, curator and writer, and indeed Peggy's granddaughter. French-born Vail is the perfect custodian to carry the legacy of the Peggy Guggenheim collection forward. I do sense that Peggy would be so pleased by that. As a cultural landmark, the Peggy Guggenheim collection is up there with the top attractions if in the Veneto region and all of Italy. With nearly 500,000 visitors each year that flock to the lagoon to admire the Deluni, the Malkovich, the Miro, the Klee, the Picasso, the Severini, the Brancusi, and so many more, the work continues to dazzle and maintain not only its 20th century roots, but its contemporary legacy. After 40 years as a public institution, the setting of the gallery and the gardens remain accessible and current, and a hit on most avid travellers' itinerary. Peggy's spirit is alive in the rooms of the gallery. When you walk in to see the Caldeur Mobile, Arc of Petals, floating in front of the large Picasso, the turquoise cubist painting, you feel that sense of possibility, the palpable aura of the great artists that have been and gone. The rooms are quiet, uncluttered, reverent. Standing in front of Vasily Kandinsky's Landscape with Red Spots No. 2. The spiritual radiance of colour and form has you practically weeping in the corner, but you can't stop there. There are more rooms, more paths, and sculptures to admire, and people around you subject to emotion, question, and rumination. The first Guggenheim Foundation director, Philip Ryland, said, quote, "She was fascinated by people and how they interacted. That was part of the reason why she had the most international salon in Venice. Part of her zest for human interaction was about her desire to really get to know other people. She was never banal, never said anything that seemed like a cliché. When she spoke, it was a direct expression of her thoughts, and she thought a great deal. She did have the rich person's fear of being taken advantage of, but she was generous. Generous to her children and grandchildren, and to artists and writers she supported and admired." End of quote. Peggy would continue to update her book out of this century, even in the final years of her life. Near the end, her biographer, Jacqueline B. Weld, sat with Peggy, documenting her life and asking questions for the book, Peggy, the Wayward Guggenheim. Peggy adored having a biographer. Appreciation and acknowledgement is all she ever really hoped for, and I sense deeply needed. As a woman who started off her art education, reading the tomes of Bernard Berenson on Italian Renaissance art, an informal education, but a willing and persistent one that would keep a rotating door of collectors, curators, buyers, and artists at her door for decades. When Jacqueline B. Weld asked Peggy, quote, "Did you feel it was a crazy life?" end of quote. Peggy quickly replied, quote, "Definitely, yes. It was all about art and love."